There's been a long-running link in American culture between issues of race and of mental illness. For long periods of time, minority groups, including African Americans and Jews, were seen as racially prone to certain types of mental illness that, based on various kinds of racial pseudoscience. But over the last century, a new idea started to get attention that racism could be seen as a kind of mental illness. And some recent news reports suggest that certain kinds of medication might actually lower people's racial biases, leading some people to think that racism could be a treatable mental health condition. Our next guest says it's way more complicated than that. Sander Gilman joins us now. He's a professor of the liberal arts and sciences as well as psychiatry at Emory University. He's the co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. Sander, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start back with that first idea I mentioned, that there's this history of linking minority groups with particular types of mental illness. You even reference a condition supposedly that made slaves want to escape. This was seen as a mental illness, in effect. This has a long history, doesn't it?
It is a very long history. And the notion really was that groups that were sort of seen as less civilized, outside the norms of moral action, were seen as predisposed either because of biology or because of culture to various forms of mental illness. You mentioned drapetomania.
That was it, yeah.
Dr. Samuel Cartwright's notion that if slaves run away, it's a symptom because, of course, benign white slavery was the proper place for a slave, and if the slave didn't see that, it was clear that they were mentally ill. These notions were applied to virtually every group you can mention, to Jews, they were applied to the Irish, to Native Americans, and it became a kind of a commonplace. People saw groups on the margin as predisposed to mental illness and therefore in need of control.
Things changed, and in large part around World War II and after the horrors of World War II, this idea began to take root that to commit horrible acts of racism, to be an extreme racist, must be some form of mental illness. Where did that idea first come about?
Well, it sort of comes about, actually, right around the time of the First World War. Assuming, by the way, that serious thinkers, and this is across the board, really did believe that minorities were predisposed to mental illness, the counter notion arises among groups that are marginalized. For example, Jewish physicians in Central Europe start to say, hey, wait a minute, we're not crazy. It's, in point of fact, a society which demonizes us, and the people in that society are crazy. And something happens which is, for me, very interesting. Because, you know, racism is a very interesting phenomenon. It is extrapolating from specific qualities, perhaps of an individual, the qualities of some kind of collective, right? The Jews, the slaves, the blacks, the Mexicans. When we know these are very complicated groups, and the idea really was that this collective, which was called race, began to have a kind of parallel, starting really in the 1890s, 1900, and that was called the mob or the crowd. And you could move the mob or the crowd to act irrationally in ways such as racism by having things like a charismatic leader. And so what happens around the First World War, and this is why it's so fascinating to me, is that British psychoanalysts and psychiatrists start to write books trying to explain the Germans. The Germans. Why are the Germans so evil and so bad? And the answer is because they're crazy. They've got a crazy leader, and they themselves are crazy. This is the First World War, right? Mm-hmm. This is the way of understanding the Bush, right? The Hun. And this collective, right, the mob, right, the crowd, comes to be absolutely parallel to the notion of the race. And so by the time the Nazis come around in the late 1920s, early 1930s, there's kind of a natural way to critique Nazism and fascism as a form of collective mental illness caused by what? The charismatic leader, Mussolini, Hitler, Franco.
We're talking to Sander Gelman about links or not between mental illness and racism. He's the co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? Well, let's get into that question now. This is a very complicated issue because how we define race differs, how we define racism differs, and the meaning of mental illness changes depending on who you talk to, and definitely over time. So start to pin down some of those ideas for us.
Well, again, you know, that's why it's so interesting. You have one set of terms, let's say race, which is in point of fact without any real boundaries. In the sense, it's kind of made up as you go along. There is, of course, a science of race, and that science of race becomes important in medicine, for example, in the 19th century. But it doesn't exist in the world. It's projection onto a specific group. You know, for example, I'll give you just one example that I've always loved, which is the notion that there are sort of physical characteristics as well as psychological characteristics that determine the membership in a group. African Americans have black skin. Well, one of the products of slavery is the fact that at the end of the 19th century, an awful lot of African Americans began to pass as white, and Mark Twain wrote one of his most stellar novels about two infants, one black and one white, but really with the same color skin, who are exchanged in the nursery. And one is raised as a shiftless black man and has all the bad black characteristics, and the other is a noble white man, except the black man is white and the white man is black. So this notion of race is, in point of fact, in a sense, constantly evoked and constantly made up. And so one of the things that's really important is this is also one of the problems with this ever-changing catalog of mental illness. So at the end of the 19th century, Jews are seen as highly predisposed to hysteria, right? They wander across nations in the Paris clinics in the 1890s. There's a young man who writes a whole dissertation about the mentally ill Jews, and he says these are the wandering Jews, and they're all hysterical, right? They're all hysterical. So you're quite right. Race is a very, very unstable category, and so is mental illness. It doesn't mean, by the way, that mental illness doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean that genetic cohorts don't exist. But what gets superimposed on these two categories are oftentimes fantasies about collectives.
Let's talk about modern-day racism now, and if we can attribute it to mental illness. And I referenced briefly, and you start your book talking about this, you know, people taking a medication, this is a few years back, that seemed to lower their inherent racial biases. So there we go. We can give somebody a pill. It'll bring down their demonstrated racism. Just not that simple, is it?
Even better, we can put it in the water like fluorine. We can get rid of racism in the whole world. We just have to give beta blockers to everybody. The difficulty with that study, it's 2012, is that what is defined as racism and what is, quote-unquote, alleviated and measured by these psychological tests is kind of inchoate. Right, it's kind of inchoate. And so a few years later, a group of people who were interested in reducing people's fears about spiders give them beta blockers. And it turns out if you keep them on beta blockers, they're no longer afraid of spiders. Is this better than behavioral therapy? No, because if you take them off of the medication, they become anxious again. So maybe the medication reduces some kind of anxiety that is triggered by the imaginary or something like that. But this is this kind of mechanical approaches to racism that we've seen recently. There is a very serious neuroanatomist who's very interested in his, well, at least his claim, that with the right kind of brain scan, he can tell in advance of a person becoming a racist whether they're going to become a racist or not. And then maybe we just give them beta blockers, and we don't even have to worry about racists because we'll get them in advance of them becoming racist.
You're skeptical of this way of thinking, if I'm reading your book right, that you don't see racism as just something that comes from a natural predisposition in our brain. There's a collective element to it, a historical element to it.
And a social element. Mm-hmm. That is, of course it comes from things in the brain. I mean, that goes without saying, right? I mean, our brains are who we are, and we are our brains. But that doesn't mean that our brains are kind of parallel processors, some kind of computer that's gone awry, because we live, everyone lives in a world, and that world creates certain images and fears and notions of proper and improper actions, which is what we start to talk about really, by the way, at same time around the First World War with people like W.E.B. Du Bois, as racism coming out of society, right? And you can't give people a pill for society. You've got to think about society as something which we hope, though the recent past gives us pause to think, can at least create laws and structures which make it difficult for people to impose their notions on other people. My rule of thumb is that people's freedom stops at the end of my nose. And so racism strikes me as something which may exist, can be ameliorated over time. We've seen that, by the way, with the changing social status of gays and lesbians in the United States, even though now, of course, transgender people have come under the microscope. But the real question really is that racism, when it's medicalized, lets people off the hook. Rather than saying you've made an evil choice, you're doing a bad and evil thing, we say to them, and we've seen this with many, many celebrities, right? They get drunk, they become unpleasant to the cop who's pulled them over, they revile him with anti-Semitic statements. When he is called on it, when the person is called on it, he says, what? I'm going into therapy, and then, therefore, I'm going to be cute.
We're talking about the relationship between racism and mental illness. Our guest is Sander Gilman, co-author of Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. What relationship do you see, if any, between racism and mental illness? Or is thinking about racism as a disease, something we can cure, a bad idea? Is it oversimplifying just to look at one person, their attitudes kind of isolated from how they were brought up, the society they live in, the history they grew up with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We pick up our conversation now with Sander Gilman, co-author of the new book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. What relationship do you see, if any, between racism and mental illness? Or is thinking about racism as a disease, as something maybe treatable, maybe with a pill, a bad idea? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Allison is on the line in Madison. Allison, hi.
Hi. What I wanted to ask about is the work of a scholar that I heard speak and read her book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And it, I wondered if your speaker's familiar with that work. And to me, it tied into what you just said about racism as a mental illness sort of being a way of, perhaps being a way of getting off the hook for the reality, this turns that on its head, and it talks about the like post-traumatic stress disorders as a generational reality stemming from, I mean, from among other things, the way that mothers would try to protect their children from the abuses of slavery through the generations.
Allison, thanks for the call. Any thoughts, Sander?
Well, there are a number of very good empirical studies recently, obviously, looking at the children and even the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, which make the point that oftentimes within these families, there are, can we say, there's an 800-pound gorilla in the room that is not acknowledged, right? The notion is that these families tend to function in such a way as either not to speak about the past, this notion of protecting, or indeed to see the present as very separate from the past. And this is, you know, one wishes one were able to take a look at the generation immediately after slavery, or even that generation subsequent to that. What happens is that we know is that this dissipates over time. But this is absolutely something that is, you know, demonstrable, which is that traumatic acts have impact. That's a very different rationale than saying, for example, that these traumatic acts then provide a kind of rationale for evil actions. That is not part of this literature. In fact, one of the things that talks about that is talked about over and over again is how these, especially second generation, tend to be kind of frozen psychologically in time and space. It's almost a form of chronic depression. So the answer is absolutely. We know this, by the way, in the survivors from the Yugoslav massacres. We know that in the survivors of genocides, that the second and third generations are oftentimes impacted.
Allison, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Richie in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Richie, hi.
Hi. My question to you, doctor, is aren't we all mentally ill to some degree?
Well, you know, again, we're back to defining things, right? The answer is, you know, Freud has a lovely definition. He says, you have psychological difficulties when you have difficulty with the two core parts of your life. And he says those are work and love. So the answer is many of us have to cope in complicated ways with the world around us. There are ways which distort our daily lives. There are ways that make us less capable of dealing with our daily lives. And so I would, you know, globally, I would say no, because we make a kind of a distinction between being able to cope and not being able to cope. And it strikes me that that's a good sort of measure when we start to talk about racism and mental illness. So, for example, I would argue that racism is not a form of mental illness. It's not a form of mental illness for the Nazis. It's not a form of mental illness for the so-called alt-right, which is basically neo-Nazis. But it is also the case that people who are severely mentally ill can focus in on, obsessively focus in on, qualities that we would think of as racist. It's a difference between a classification which says racists are all mentally ill, and we can say that some mentally ill focus in on their neighbor who is Muslim and focus in also on the fact that the CIA is trying to read their thoughts. So I would be careful about saying we are all mentally ill, you know, maybe except you and me.
Briefly, as we start to wrap up, Sander, is part of the problem in having these kind of conversations that it seems like racism is a yes or no, either or binary thing? Either you're a full, as commonly defined, you are a member of a white nationalist organization, or you don't have a racist bone in your body, and there's not, people don't recognize a continuum there?
There's a complete continuum. And one of the things that making people responsible for their statements and actions, including members, by the way, of outgroups, of minorities, right? I mean, I had a student years ago who, as a satire, right, is really a satire, said that gay people could not be prejudiced. And she said, of course gay people can be prejudiced. They can be prejudiced against, but they also can be prejudiced. So one wants to really be careful about thinking of these collectives, just as we really will avoid one of talking about race as a reality. Talking about racists as a kind of easily defined collective is something we also want to avoid.
We'll leave it there for now. Sander, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Sander Gilman. He's professor of the liberal arts and sciences and psychiatry at Emory University. He's the co-author of the book, Are Racists Crazy? How Prejudice, Racism, and Anti-Semitism Became Markers of Insanity. It's still time to share your thoughts on that and other topics over on the Central Time Facebook page. Just head over. You can find links to information about this and some of the other conversations we have there. By the way, take a minute to go to WPR.org if you're looking for new ways to listen to Central Time and all your other favorite shows, maybe outside of the car or the home radio. Check out WPR.org and download the WPR app. Make that an early New Year's resolution. You'll be able to listen on your smartphone. There's Android and Apple versions. And you can listen on your phone or tablet while you are cooking, exercising, or whatever you want to do. Again, that's the WPR app. You can download it over at WPR.org.